Also, I'm answering my mail. It comes as fast as it gets here, so be patient with me. Quite a few letters, but I do get to them. And just hold on. If you have questions about any of the conspiracies that I haven't touched on the radio, or that you haven't heard, or new evidence coming in that you want to know about, or investigations of the past, send me a letter to KLRB, Carmel, California, and I'll answer those questions on the air for you instead of putting it in a letter if there's something you want me to describe about the various conspiracies. Also, I was busy all summer with the Watergate, after the Watergate story came, the SLA this year, and my work piled up. The newspapers are piled up. The Watergate articles are 3 or 4 feet high, and I need help to cut the articles. I used to have a team of students and people that volunteered to come in and cut articles. So if you have time next Sunday, I thought I'd have an open house and a potluck, and if you want to bring a scissors and a stapler, those of you in the local area, and you want to spend 3 or 4 or 5 hours just cutting newspaper articles to help get through the pile, I thought I'd announce that. And there's a lot of high school and college students in our area that offered to help, and I never set a time because I've been too busy. So next Sunday on the 29th of September, if you feel like coming in the morning and spending the day and you're ready to cut a lot of articles for me, I can use some help along those lines. If you don't have the Realist magazine with the articles that I've written for them, for Paul Krasner, you can subscribe for $3 a year at 595 Broadway, New York 10012. You can send for single copies here to me at KLRB, Carmel, California. It's 75 cents for a single copy plus the postage. If you have send self-addressed envelopes, I'll send you bibliographies of books to read in the following year, some good books that would give you a clue on how these conspiracies came down. And if you have any more questions, as I say, write to me. There's a magazine called Counterspy, comes out quarterly, which is an excellent magazine. The new edition just came. It's the address is Box 647, Franklin Station, Washington, D.C., 20044. This is put out by the Fifth Estate. It's a group of men that were in the intelligence service that are trying to expose the clandestine operations that do not benefit our country, that they feel aren't in the best interest of our country, that do damage to our country. And the new issue is $1.50 is very valuable. It just came this week. They have a section called Undercover Agents, a profile of undercover agents, the ideology of the internal security, the hidden posse at Wounded Knee, and the CIA target, labor and clandestine enforcement of U.S. labor policies. Those are the four subjects they cover in this new issue. It's called Counterspy, Fall 74 issue. It's only $1.50. And if you read these things, you get a background of some of the sources of the information that I'm getting, and then we can be reading it together at the same time. That's Box 647, Ben Franklin Station, Washington, D.C., 20044. Well, the news that came in today on the wire services was that a young man by the name of Ron Wood was murdered in Carson City in Nevada in the jail. And Ron Wood claimed that he knew he would be murdered, or he was afraid he would be murdered, because he had shared a cell with Sirhan Sirhan, and Sirhan told him about the murder of Robert Kennedy as best as he could remember it, and that he did not fire the fatal bullets, that there was another gunman in the room. And he gave a lot of information to Ron Wood, and then Ron was afraid that his life was in danger, so he was moved to Nevada, where he was stabbed, yesterday, and the news came over today. Ron was murdered. But before he died, he passed a letter off to an attorney or public official sharing the evidence about the assassination of Robert Kennedy and how he thought his life was in danger, and this material was in the hands of public officials before he died. Now, maybe this it will be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Maybe this case will open up, because it certainly deserves to be opening up. It is common knowledge in the national literature and up and down the state of researchers, and we've said it on the air, and it's been published, a lot of this information, that there was a second gun, that Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy. And the district attorney, Evel Younger, who covered up the investigation of this murder, and if I call it Watergate West, is now the Attorney General of California. He's running again in November to be the Attorney General of California. He was a defendant in a lawsuit that charged him with covering up the truth of this murder. And now we have the death of a man who had information about it, and he was not allowed to live his life out because he had shared this cell with Sirhan or had access to Sirhan, and he's been murdered. And this brings to mind what I've been saying all along, is the collusion of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council working with the Department of Corrections, with the prison system. And I've talked on my radio show, in fact, I did an outline that I wanted to do next week, on some more on the CIA and the Department of Corrections and how they work hand in glove. And it reminds me of the case of Robert Hyde, who I've done many radio shows on, who has a case before the Monterey County Grand Jury. He's taken on the grand jury, the Monterey District Attorney's Office. He's filed a case on contracts to murder him by allegedly the guards out at Soledad Prison, at Folsom Prison, giving weapons to inmates to murder Robert Hyde. And Robert Hyde also, like Ron Wood, is knowledgeable about the Robert Kennedy assassination and the John Kennedy assassination, and also how the SLA was formed by the Department of Corrections and the CIA. And Robert Hyde is a man whose life I have been trying to save. Maybe if I knew Ron Wood, this thing wouldn't have gone as far as it has. Hyde was sent to Vacaville, where he was to have his brain removed or altered so that his memory wouldn't go back to these conspiracies. That was halted. He was sent back to Soledad, where there were contracts to murder him. That was halted. He was sent to Folsom, where there were contracts to murder him. He has a lawsuit. He's placing a charge now on that. He's now at Chino. I got a letter from him just today telling me, you know, that he feels that I've saved his life. At Vacaville, saved his brain, saved him from being a robot, saved him from being murdered at these various prisons. When he arrived down at Chino, I wrote to the warden down there and said, okay, now Hyde's in your hands. He's knowledgeable about the Robert Kennedy murder, the forming of the SLA, narcotics traffics inside the prison, and the guards hiring other prisoners to murder him. He knows about these things and about the contract to murder Sirhan up at San Quentin, if the case were ever to get close to opening. And I said, now he's in your hands, and I'm going to place a lawsuit against you if you kill him. I have a complaint in a lawyer's hands now in the event that Robert Hyde is ever murdered. He said maybe he would be the straw that would break the camel's back, and he feels that his death is imminent. And I get a letter maybe 2 days a week from him. He's down at Chino, and I wrote down there. And since I got in touch with the fourth prison where he's been, he said they're treating him very nice down at Chino. He's finally getting some sunlight. He's still alive. He feels the CIA will move in and still try to murder him for the things that he knows. Now, these things should be going before grand juries. They should be going before the Justice Department, the FBI. Hyde's trouble started, if you remember, when he called the FBI to tell them about the conspiracies. And it's because of this network of the FBI and the CIA working with the Department of Corrections, the way they come in collusion and murder these men who are knowledgeable about the assassinations in identical fashion that Jack Ruby was murdered in a police department in the Dallas jail. Something should be done, and I don't know why people don't protest or write to Congress, because this is a national problem. It isn't a state problem. Who do you turn to when your attorney general is named or involved in this particular case in the state of California? Well, now this matter's in Nevada, and we'll see how far it can go in investigating it there. But Ron Wood is dead. He knew he'd be dead because he knew something about the truth of who murdered Robert Kennedy. This is the 10th anniversary today of the infamous Warren Report. September the 24th, actually tomorrow, 1973, Lyndon Johnson presented the biggest piece of pie, the biggest lie to the American people that they had yet been dished out. It was the story of who killed John Kennedy, President Kennedy, Officer Tippit, and Lee Harvey Oswald. Martha Mitchell was in England this week on the David Frost show. Maybe you read the remark. She was quoting George Wallace as saying, Nixon was the one who had me shot. Then Mrs. Mitchell went on and said that Wallace had proof of a White House link with the attack on his shooting. He said that the White House Dirty Tricks Department, a member, had visited Bramer before the shooting. The reason I bring it up in commemoration to the Warren report was that Mrs. Mitchell said she believed there was, in quote, a connection between some of the political assassinations in the United States during the past decade. I think there is a link, she said. I have studied it very carefully, and I think there must be some kind of a link. And she went on to say the Watergate break-in was planned as early as 1968 after that election campaign. Well, I have a picture of Martha Mitchell holding my realist, the article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped?, in which it goes into the Watergate, and then the article goes into the American assassins, and then how Nixon came to power. And Martha was holding that. Somebody took it to her as a gift on her television broadcast, and she's read it carefully, and she studied it, and now she's speaking as if she's read The Realist, and maybe she has other sources of information. After all, she was the Attorney General's wife, but she's linking the past political assassinations up to the Watergate. The National Tatler magazine has an anniversary issue this week, the week of September 29th, 1974. It's on the Watergate. It says Watergate glare catches up, and it links the Watergate to the past JFK tragedy. It says it catches up to the JFK tragedy. And this Tatler article written by John Mulder goes into the links of how many people at the Watergate were connected to the John Kennedy assassination, and it mentions Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford and the role of Leon Jaworski and John Connally, and even John Dean's wife. You know, she's a narcotic agent, and I believe she was assigned at the time he was arrested. They were meeting and getting ready for their honeymoon, that famous honeymoon that was described at the Watergate hearings. John Dean's wife, Maureen, was once wed to George Owen, who's been accused of gambling ties with Jack Ruby and close links to Jack Ruby. Well, Tatler has a long article on the major persons in the Kennedy assassination, the very top people that were involved in that assassination, how Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford to be on the Warren Commission as the acting Republican and former vice president. And it even goes into my article in The Realist. It mentions The Realist and gives me credit for some of the links. The National Tatler goes into current links that other people are beginning to put together. This is John Mulder. It's a good article with a lot of information in it. September 29th, 1974. You know, the Tatler has an issue for 50 cents on the Robert Kennedy assassination with all the evidence of the second gun. It's a 10-page supplement for only 50 cents. And they also have a supplement on the John Kennedy assassination on the 10th anniversary of his death, which came out in November. You can order those. And this one linking the Watergate to the Kennedy assassination is a very interesting one put out on the anniversary of the Warren Report. There was a news article. I'm going to jump down to San Diego now to another problem in our state, which is a national problem. And the Watergate Committee in Washington very carefully covered it up, the Senate Select Committee, and Richard Nixon was able to hush over it as long as he can, but the documentation exists to break it wide open, so Watergate isn't far behind us. But here's a little story that was in the Los Angeles Times this last week on the 19th that opens up a whole lot of new wounds. The lead article is by Mr. Trout, says, San Diego County Supervisor admits pranks on the left. Now, he put pranks in quotes, and the article is about a supervisor that was just voted in 1972. He was elected to the Board of Supervisors in San Diego, and his name is Lou Conde. And he now has admitted that he disrupted a Peace and Freedom Party open house. He turned the electricity off when they were having a party. Then he called and told them there was a bomb in the house, and he was going to hang a college professor, Herbert Marcuse, in effigy at the UC campus down in San Diego. Previously, a year ago, at the time of his hearings or election, which is typical when people are taking oaths or interviewed about their participation in something, even Gerald Ford does it, they make one statement, men, and then they deny what they said or they go ahead and act differently when they're appointed. He previously denied any involvement in any pranks on the left when before he got elected on the Board of Supervisors. But now a report is coming out that's going to be made public about Mr. Conde's activities with the Minutemen, linked to the White House, linked to the FBI, and linked to Donald Segretti. Now, Conde, as I say, was elected just recently to the Board of Supervisors in 72, and he kept this quiet for 2 years. But a California public interest research group has been exposing and has started to expose Mr. Conde. And this is very important. They're called the CalPERG. It's the California Public Interest Research Group. And they did and are doing profiles on the county supervisors. There's five of them in San Diego and eight state legislatures. And this is similar to the Fifth Estate that just got out that issue of CounterSpy, where private investigators are doing work that the Justice Department should be doing, but the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, is in on these conspiracies and covers these conspiracies, so that the California Public Interest Research Group, just like I am doing private research as an individual, and they have a group working together there all over the country, there are people like myself, either individually or meeting up with others, now I'm forming groups, to expose some of the public servants who have been part of conspiracies and try to find out what's really happening in our cities. Now, Conde, it turns out, was active with the Minutemen during the late 1960s. And it was a period of a lot of harassment and violence against the left. And the secret army organization, a group down in San Diego, was formed. This is the Minutemen, who were directly responsible for firebombings and shootings, attempted assassinations, and harassing phone calls. In 1967, Mr. Conde, Lou Conde, and Howard Berry Godfrey, who was an FBI informant, went to this Peace and Freedom Party. Later, they switched out the lights and called about a bomb threat. And they admitted that they took this figure of Professor Marcuse and were going to hang it. But their original plan was to actually hang Mr. Marcuse. But they scraped the idea and only did him in effigy. But they are capable of assassination and murder, this group, and they were going to hang Herbert Marcuse, but they hung him in effigy. In 1973, a little over a year ago, information came out more about how the FBI financed the ultra-right-wing paramilitary group. And I'm going into this in detail today because our dear Attorney General, William Saxby, has warned us about vigilantes in this country, that within 10 years this country will be so unbearable and the people have to take the law into their own hands. And also this week the FBI was warning us about terror bombings and having to bug the left because there's so much terror that's going to take place and bombings that we have to increase the war against the left. And what I want to show is that the secret army organization was allowed to exist and was formed by the FBI, mainly by the FBI, and provided weapons and ammunition that planned kidnappings and actually did violences and destructions. And yet all this evidence was available when the Watergate Committee was investigating the elections in 72 and refused to go into the Segretti links to the White House and Herbert Kalbach and the secret army organization. Well, the secret army organization got its money and from one of its founding members, whose name is Howard Godfrey, who was a paid FBI informer. And Godfrey of the FBI supplied the secret army organization with the money it needed to print their recruitment literature. In other words, they were attracting the vigilantes on the street that Saxby's warning us about. The FBI gave the money to the secret army organization to recruit vigilantes, militants, patriotic militants, so to speak. Now, Godfrey of the FBI happened to be one of the most outspoken militants in the secret army organization, and he was urging these people to commit violence. You see, Saxby is warning us that 10 years from now, the streets won't be safe, there's nowhere to turn, we won't know where to go. This is his quotation this week. There won't be a place to go, no longer a place to hide, he says. No safe zones, not for anybody. Vigilantes may take the law into their own hands. This is what Saxby's telling us. But down in San Diego, the bulk of the, in addition to the recruitment money, the bulk of the violence was spoken by Mr. Godfrey of the FBI. Now, Godfrey of the FBI participated in break-ins. He not only provided the money to recruit militants to hassle the left, Remember, what the left was doing was they were calling attention to an illegal war in Southeast Asia. That was the extent of what they were doing, and some people could interpret that years from now as being a very patriotic gesture, identical, say, to the Germans objecting to a war in Poland or Czechoslovakia. But the FBI sought to make war against the left and the new left and the anti-war people. There was an underground newspaper in San Diego called the Street Journal. The offices were wrecked. The equipment was wrecked, the printing equipment, several thousand dollars worth. They firebombed left-wing the cars of left-wing activists. These are anti-war people. They participated in the shooting of one anti-war activist, and they shot through the window of where a professor was sitting and hit the elbow of a woman who was sitting in his home. After the shooting, they took the gun to another FBI contact, and they hid the weapon from the police. The FBI were part of this, and the police allegedly were looking for what was happening if they weren't part of it. They burglarized the Message Information Center down in San Diego, the counterculture outpost, and they stole the records from the office. This is your FBI providing the money for recruitment and the weapons and the talk for violence to the secret army organization, which is an extremely anti-Semitic, anti-black Minutemen organization down in San Diego. Davis, one of the person that was involved in the shooting, said you might say that the secret army organization was, in quotes, a federally funded program from the right wing. Now, this is important because Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur from Los Angeles, spoke about that a few years ago also, and I'll go into his allegations. As I say, they were riding in a car. They put a bullet through a window and shot Paula Tharp in the arm and shot her elbow. Now, there is a direct link through documentation that exists of Richard Nixon's White House, linked through the police departments and the FBI to the California Minutemen, to the meetings of Donald Segretti. Donald Segretti from the White House, who was at the Judge Advocate's office at Fort Ord, and then went into the White House secret team, the secret army team. He was a connecting link. He was hired by Dwight Chapin, his schoolmate from USC, appointment secretary for the White House, and he was paid by Herbert Kalmbach, the attorney for Richard Nixon. Segretti went to the funny farm down at Lompoc for about a 6 month prison term and came out looking clean as a rose, and there were no investigations into Segretti's 1972 payments and instigations for violence that were supposed to take place if the Republican convention took place in San Diego. Segretti talked allegedly down at the headquarters. They met at a special camp, I'll tell you where it was, and they talked about kidnapping radical leaders at the time of the GOP convention. Now, these allegations come from one source, and they're not any different than the John Mitchell, G. Gordon Liddy plans in Miami, where they were going to kidnap radicals, give acid to politicians, and take them out of the country. In April 72, the plans were moved for the Republican convention from San Diego to Miami. But the meetings that were taking place in California just prior to the plans to move were just as good. They were in March 72, is when Ronald Johnson, a 30-year-old student from San Diego State University, told the editors of Door, that's an underground newspaper in San Diego, that he met with Donald Segretti in March 72 at the U.S. Grand Hotel in San Diego. I'm going into this again because we have the Attorney General telling us we're going to have terrorism on the streets. We have the head of the FBI, Mr. Kelly, telling us we have to bug the leftists. And here you have the White House appointment secretary, the president's attorney, all of them involved in, through Mr. Segretti as a liaison, meeting with the Minutemen to cause violence, providing the means for shootings on the streets, for firebombing cars, breaking into offices, shooting through windows. And until these things are solved, we shouldn't allow the funds or the arms for the vigilantes that are in power now, like the U.S. Attorney General or Mr. Kelly. I call them the vigilantes because their job is to investigate these matters, and they're protecting them. Segretti was interested in what Mr. Johnson knew about local radical, what he called troublemakers. This is down in San Diego. This is what Ronald Johnson said, a student from San Diego State. He said, he told me that if I located any troublemakers, meaning people that opposed the war or would give Nixon a bad trouble or have demonstrations, I suppose, at the convention, that they could be gotten rid of. I asked him what he meant by that. And he said they could be sent out of town for a limited time. Johnson rejected Segretti's appeal for work against the radicals. And this proposal was made by Segretti 2 months after Liddy's proposal had been presented down in Miami, and according to John Mitchell, was rejected by the Nixon committee, but we know it wasn't rejected. Segretti was reported on several occasions to be seen at the Gunsmoke Ranch in El Cajon, California, with members of the right-wing secret army organization. The Gunsmoke Ranch is where members practice firing their rifles. As I say, Segretti worked in the Judge Advocate's office at Fort Ord in California. He traveled under the alias of Donald Sims, and Sims was present when the Minutemen discussed the Republican convention, and an unidentified companion of his did the talking, and he sat and listened. Now, what is the purpose of the secret army organization? And why does the FBI finance them? And why does the White House send Segretti, a lawyer, to meet with these people? According to Jerry Davis, the Secret Army was formed in 71, and the purpose was to train guerrillas who would organize a resistance movement should the U.S. be conquered by a foreign power. Now, we know this country isn't going to be conquered by a foreign power, but it makes more sense to look at the news this week of the vigilantes in Britain, where military people, the right-wing law and order forces run by former military people, are forming vigilante groups in order to stave off if there's food riots or starvation or the society is under, in quotes, a severe strain from galloping inflation, rising unemployment, stagnant levels of production. As the savings evaporate, everyone wants a share of the shrinking pie. So in Great Britain, which is fairly close, it's very similar to the United States, in their policies, the CIA and the British intelligence are one. In Great Britain, they have certain leaders like Sir Walter Walker, former commander of the NATO, with a secret army of 100,000 followers. They have another army led by a prominent person, David Sterling, a former colonel in World War II and a hero from World War II, who's recruiting mercenaries for Africa, and now he runs what he calls Great Britain in 1975. These armies are getting prepared to take over power plants, sewage works, key services, wherever there would be strikes or picket lines. So compare the problems in the United States, strains on the inflation, rising unemployment, stagnant levels of production, and so forth, and you can see the problems are similar. And therefore, the answer to why these guerrillas are being trained by the military in this country, identical to the way they're being trained in England, and they're calling them vigilantes, is that as prices go up and there's unemployment and racism and riots and the ghettos are drugged with all kinds of hard drugs being poured in, and then crime is increased to keep the habit, as all this is taking place, we have what we have forming the vigilantes, and they're not vigilantes at all. I want to make the point that they're military people ordered out of the National Security Council, from the CIA, from the FBI, and that they're very carefully synchronizing it so that it doesn't look like a civil war is being forced of the military against the people. It looks like the private citizens are forming armies, getting ready in case the people on the streets get too hungry or anxious for jobs. The point is that the secret army has not been investigated, that it does link to the White House, and the documentation exists. So when Mr. Saxby warns us about the vigilantes, we have to go into these allegations. It was Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur, that worked for the police department for 9 years, who revealed the documentation on the secret army organization. He has documents he was going to mail to me. We talked about this on the phone just this last week, and he has evidence to prove the links of the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department to the Secret Army Organization, to the FBI, and to the White House. Now, all of this just surfaced this week, as I say. It started out in the open again because Supervisor Lou Conde became exposed by private researchers doing what the Justice Department should be doing and should be looking into. In Washington, D.C., Archibald Cox, as the investigator for the Watergate before he was fired, didn't want to go into the Segretti case at all. He didn't want to go beyond the Ellsberg case. He didn't touch anything that Donald Segretti did out in California in San Diego. The investigators avoided the links of Donald Segretti to the White House, his fundings, and his plans for violence at the Republican conventions to blame radicals and kidnap the left in 1972. John Ehrlichman, in anger, and what I interpret as blackmail, has asked for his trial. And I mentioned it last week that when he comes to trial on the Watergate, he wants the Segretti papers. Now, all you have to do is ask for the Segretti papers, and you're opening up a bombshell, because you can see what this would imply if Ehrlichman gets into the Segretti papers. The key to Ehrlichman's defense of getting him off, it would be information on Donald Segretti. Segretti is important to the Wallace shooting and funds that go to Arthur Brammer, and I think the links of Donald Segretti, known as Donald Sims, up in Milwaukee, should be checked out, and they haven't been checked out by the FBI or Justice Department, and they're sitting on this like they'll sit on everything else, whether it's the Kent State or any other investigation, unless the public just forces it out in the open. Howard Godfrey, the FBI member, as I say, of the Minutemen, is working now. He's a fireman in Sacramento. That's where he's working. The same gentleman who let out the first shots at Kent State is working in the police department in Washington, D.C. Howard Godfrey is now in Sacramento. Jerry Lynn Davis, a member of the Secret Army Organization, commander of the Minutemen, is out of Chino on probation. He's out on probation. And Louis Tagwood claims that these teams, the FBI and the right wing and the right-wing paramilitary, are all part of a national police force which is forming, which is disguised like these vigilantes, and they want incidences. They want these shootings and bringings, counter charges or hanging effigies. They want street demonstrations in order to hasten their ability to get into power. Tagwood claimed in conjunction with this, he claimed 4 years ago, that Nixon didn't mean a thing to this power team at all. They used his secret police team for their floor plans, and that he was unimportant to the whole thing. Tagwood also mentioned that Mr. Godfrey of the FBI and a member of the Minutemen and the secret organization had also obtained floor plans and blueprints of McGovern's headquarters for the convention, had it been in San Diego. Now, at the time of the Watergate hearings, there were White House tapes dated July 14th, 1974, where the subject of Donald Segretti came up. I take it back, these were March 13th, the tapes of Richard Nixon, 1973, in the White House. March 13th, they talked about Chappaquiddick, and they talked about Segretti on these tapes. The White House was determined to cover up and protect everything that had to do with Donald Segretti in those tapes. There was fear that the Watergate-associated crimes and the minor things that they did would rub off into the entire Segretti affair, which would lead to Robert Haldeman, which would show that Haldeman hired Segretti and that Herbert Kalmbach's private records paid money to Segretti, Donald Segretti, as well as the Chappaquiddick affair, to, in quotes, investigate the Chappaquiddick affair. And the president was absolutely convinced that the press would believe that Dwight Chapin had acted on his own instead of part of the White House to recruit Segretti, and that would get them off the dirty tricks of what Segretti was about. Richard Nixon said in his tapes, he called the Segretti affair spongy. He said it's not good stuff, it would be too risky. He said the concern of hiding the Segretti affair was behind John Dean's successful effort to get federal prosecutors to sidestep any question of involvement of the Segretti affair or of Herbert Kalmbach, who paid Segretti his salary with expenses that came from the Nixon campaign funds. Now, this is important because as the Justice Department and the California State Attorney General talk about new violences coming out, there's a press release today of Evel Younger on new violence, waves of violence coming out. How much violence is coming from the FBI funding the provocateurs identical to the war demonstrations during the last decade, where we had the students demonstrating to object to the war in Vietnam and the bombings, and the provocateurs were providing all the show that the press was carrying to show cars overturned, buildings being burned, and shootings. Everything was blamed on the students, and nothing was blamed on the public officials. The SLA, I bring up the SLA today in conjunction to the Secret Army Organization in San Diego because part of the birth of the SLA was in San Diego. And there's a tight espionage link between Florida and San Diego and California law enforcement in all of this. It can be documented and charted out, but it can't be given on one radio show. The news this week also, and I said it before, Director Clarence Kelly is warning us that his agency needs broad wiretaps to deal with revolutionaries who plant bombs. And he uses the example of the bombings of three people killed at the Los Angeles airport and the handling of aliens and the judge that was murdered in Washington, D.C., and various bombs going off at military recruitment centers. And I think the only way that you can stop the continuation of wiretapping and harassment of the left, and the left is anybody who criticizes the national policies, is to investigate carefully each case of bombing and see what he's talking about, because I have alleged that the bombing in Los Angeles that our head of the FBI is talking about was a member of the Galen operation, that he's an agent provocateur, Mr. Kerbovich, the deaf mute, and I don't believe a word that he is part of a terrorist left-wing group at all. He's part of a right-wing military operation with his germ warfare and his weapons. And until we find out more about Mr. Kerbovich, the FBI should not be allowed to have more wiretapping privileges. I think you should write to Mr. Kelly and tell him that you challenge each case, that he should prove that the left is doing the terrorism, and write to members of Congress and see if you can convince them to investigate each case at a time. The SLA was created by these forces in order to get more muscle. And so Mr. Kelly says, well, we have the SLA, we need more wiretapping. They wanted enough radicals to justify further repression, to get them out on the streets and get excited about oppressions which they're not even feeling yet at this time. I understand there's a new SLA group in Berkeley dealing in cocaine right under the nose of the police, wielding guns and getting ready for a second round of showing off. I got a letter from the SLA today, an interesting letter I should read on the mail, on the air, and I must say I'm getting a good cross-section of mail this week. I got one from members of the SLA, I got one from the leader of the Black Cultural Association of Vacaville, I got a message to contact a member of the White Area Knights, and several letters from the John Birch Society. So when you assimilate the information that people have to offer or the things they're saying and you put it together, I still am suspicious of the SLA being a widespread plot, and they're thumbing their nose and saying they're getting ready for a new big operation. But they're up at Berkeley, as I say, dealing in cocaine, wielding their guns under the nose of the police. So you can expect a big round of radical terrorists and then a counterattack by the police force, and all this is going to happen. There's only one course of action to take, as far as I can see. And before Mr. Kelly gets permission to broaden his wiretap powers to deal with revolutionaries, he should be forced to prove which bombings and which kidnappings and acts of terrorism came from the left, just like all the provocateurs surfaced after the war demonstrations. He should be able to prove about the weapons and where the military support is coming from. It was very hushed up in the news this week, but a gentleman from back east in Kentucky was apprehended or given a slap on the wrist because one of his weapons was found in the custody of Donald DeFries in Los Angeles. But nobody tells you where the man from Kentucky came from. He wasn't a leftist, he wasn't a radical, and his weapons were supplied to shoot allegedly at policemen or people in the streets of Los Angeles. Who is this man? There wasn't much said about him except that the weapons were traced back to Kentucky, one of the or more weapons of Donald DeFries. It'd be interesting to see where they came from. If you studied the anti-war demonstrations and the violence of the 60s or 70s, you know that these are government agent provocateurs, just like the bombings, the firebombings in San Diego and the breaking of print and press, shooting through windows and so forth. And you can clear up these bombing cases, but you can't give Evel Younger, the Attorney General in California, or Mr. Kelly, the head of the FBI, or Mr. Saxby, the Attorney General of the United States, carte blanche to get new arms, new forces, and scare you with all this talk of terrorism unless they can prove that their armed forces are not supplying the terrorists with the weapons they need. Well, time is running out. I only have about 3 minutes. I want to talk about Stephen Bingham, allegedly a radical lawyer that surfaced in Canada, alive and well. He's in the news this week. I wrote about him in July 73, saying he was in Canada. I'm right on the button on that. I said that Louis Tagwood told me he has tapes of Bingham made in Canada, saying that he was linked, or allegedly he has been linked, to the LAPD, again, the criminal conspiracy section. And I accused him in my article, The Realist, of being an agent provocateur that surfaced to supposedly give a gun to George Jackson the day that George Jackson was murdered. And following the shootout at San Quentin, where the prison system murdered George Jackson and 3 guards and 2 inmates, then came the charges against 6 radicals who became famous as the San Quentin Six. Bingham had visited prison that day. Bingham is living in Canada, and he tells us he's a Marxist-Leninist. I'm very suspicious of his surfacing at this time, and he certainly is not helping anything but the forces of oppression. You see, now the Attorney General can say, oh, we have this radical in Canada, this communist who's breaking the law. He's in Canada. We have Patty Hearst, a refugee from the law, and we have Timothy Leary now snitching on the left, and there'll be a purge of the left, and Stephen Bingham surfacing at this time is hardly a coincidence. I've followed this case. If the trial comes up on the San Quentin Six, which has been temporarily put off, there'll be a decision in October. If they still have to go to trial, the future jury, wherever they are, will be reading that Stephen Bingham, a Marxist-Leninist, won't tell them if he supplied the gun or didn't supply the gun, but they're going to link him to the worldwide weatherman, and a reign of terror will come down on all of these groups, and the people that will get it will be the leftists. Bingham isn't serving any purpose except law enforcement at this time. He's fitting traditionally into the provocateur role. I stated a year ago the radicals were angry that I wrote this about him, and his surfacing now is very interesting in light of the amount of harm he can do, and he serves no earthly purpose. And one way to check out the Bingham story, I got a lot of calls from radio stations around the country today at the house about Bingham and also the murder of Sirhan's friend. The way to check it out, he met with a lawyer. It would be interesting to know if his lawyer contact is CIA and also a provocateur, if they're radicals or provocateurs. Well, time is running out. I'll do more on the Bingham story next week because it's really important. In the meanwhile, stay well, and I'll see you next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Bressel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California. Thank you.